Hey, good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. This program is sponsored by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and we invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks again for joining us tonight.
Hey, good evening, Bill.
And once again, we invite you to call in tonight with your questions. Cliff will answer your questions, anything about the avian world and birds, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We also encourage you to send us emails and sounds of birds that you would like identified with Cliff, and you can send those to my email address. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. wbeckett@lsus.edu, and this information can be found on our website. Cliff, at the end of last month's program, you gave us a conservation tip, as you always do. Could you refresh our memories a bit?
We talked about bridges and culverts, and you might think, well, how the heck does that relate to my birds and the birds I love outside? Well, it does, because you can put in a bridge, and especially a culvert, incorrectly that messes everything up along your waterway, and then all of a sudden the kids aren't catching fish, and the birds aren't catching fish like your belted kingfisher or your Louisiana water thrush isn't catching little invertebrates. So you want to make sure if you're putting in a bridge or a culvert on your property, or if you know of the county working on bridges and culverts in your area, on waterways that are active year-round. We're not talking about roadside ditches and the culvert under your driveway where just for runoff for rain. We're talking about permanently flowing water that may experience a dry spell where all of a sudden, like a bathtub, everything drains out. All the water and everything that goes with it, all the flora and fauna that goes with it. Well, here come the rains weeks or days or months later and puts it all back in, just like filling up your bathtub. Well, the critters can't go back and forth if you've got a culvert with a drop-off. Like a waterfall. You can't have that, because think about how are things going to go back upstream. So a buddy of mine, Dave Peterson, alerted me to this years ago, and he worked in with me on crafting that conservation tip. So thanks to Dave, because it's a big issue. It's one I really didn't think about until I saw him give a talk at a conference about it. And he was talking about fishes, and I was thinking about birds, and my wheels started turning. I thought, this is an issue for a lot of our birds. So do bridges and culverts correctly. We talked about also when working on that bridge or culvert to divert sediment that's draining down your road. If you've got a ranch road, you want to put in wing or leadoff ditches, because the sediment running down the roads that then dumps into your creek can cause problems. That's too much water, and it's dirty water, because actually our biggest pollutant of our water is, of all things, sediment. Hmm. So we think of, you know, that's a trick question. What's our biggest pollutant of water? People might say milk jugs, cigarette butts. No, it's actually sediment. It's, you know, our friend, dirt, but picked up from somewhere else and move somewhere else. And then if you're a fish that likes clear water, that turbidity, that thick, heavy, mucky water that's now soupy with sediment load is not good for a lot of critters. And actually, if you are paying attention to what's happening in California right now after the wildfire, that's not unusual. We went through that in my state, mm-hmm. in Texas, in, what was that, 2011, yeah. with the Bastrop fire. It burned everything in the ground. Well, just wait. It's chased by a flood, and there's no vegetation to hold that soil together, to keep it stable. And here comes a flood and washes it all away. So Bastrop went through that. We thought, gosh, this fire was terrible, and it was. And I'm glad it's over. No, a few weeks later, floods came, and it made it even worse, because all of a sudden you've got soil moving by the tonnage. And that's going on right now in the Ventura area, Santa Barbara area of California. That's what happens after these catastrophic fires. It burns everything to the soil. There's nothing to hold the soil together. So think about that when you're putting in your bridges and culverts. Think about minimizing the amount of soil that you put in your creek and make sure that that flow of the water can go back and forth, up and downstream, so the critters can as well.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds in our avian world are welcome. That's 800-552-8502. Let's get started with this month's program, Cliff, and talk about our spotlight species this month. What do we got?
We profile a different bird every episode. And this month I've picked the great horned owl. And so that species is found across the Red River listening area, and more importantly, from Alaska south to Brazil and Argentina. It has one of the greatest distributions of native birds in this hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere. Their voice involves deep hooting as heard here. Two singing back and four duetting. Let's listen. It's very dove-like, and it sounds like he's saying, or she, "Who's awake? Me too. Who's awake? Me too." So that's a good handle for remembering the great horned owl. The dove-like hoots that sound like, "Who's awake? Me too." They eat a variety of mid-sized mammals. They really, really love eating skunk. Imagine that. They're large and husky owl. They have these ear tufts that are actually just long, showy plumes. They have nothing to do with hearing. They're just for show. They nest usually in an abandoned hawk or crow nest. There are exceptions. There's some, nests on the ground in caves. I've seen nests, abandoned great blue heron nests and heronries. So they'll use a variety of things. The thing is with great horned owls, they don't build a nest. They use an old one that someone else has abandoned. Around here, they begin their nesting cycle in the colder winter months, like now. And so we actually received, coincidentally, a sound recording from one of our listeners. So why don't you tell us who sent that in, and we're going to play that.
All right, this was an eerie audio that came in at night. Renata Smolaga from Shreveport wrote, "Cliff, last night we recorded some strange creatures' calls in our backyard. Could you please identify the attached audio file?" And the Smolagas live in Shreveport here, so we'll play that again. Sounds like something out of a scary movie.
It does. And so that's a great horned owl. So there are begging calls that they do, the young that are interesting. There are some contact calls that great horns do. It's not just the deep hooting that we heard. So she sent that to us a few weeks ago, and it was just coincidentally that we were going to profile the great horned owl. So thanks for sending that in from your backyard. And that's a really good recording, too. So the great horned owl weighs a little over 3 pounds, which is pretty heavy for a bird, for an owl. And the females are a little bit larger and heavier than the males. The great horned owl is chiefly nocturnal, but you can see one in the day when they're roosting. And I have to mention that only 4 or 5 days ago, south of Bossier, my family and I, on Friday, we took the day. That was our final day of the kids not having school. We thought, hey, let's go check out the new aquarium in Shreveport. So we drove to Shreveport, and then we went down to the Red River National Wildlife Refuge headquarters south of Bossier. And we're driving through the pecan grove, and of course they're all leafless this time of the year, and there's tons of these big trees, and something just didn't look right off to my left, and I stopped. And sure enough, there's an adult, mature, perfectly healthy great horned owl, 35, 40 feet up in a tree, roosting. But it looked like a stub. But what caught my eye is just that it was a perfect vertical stub, and it had these big ear tufts. And so we stopped our car. There's no one else around, and the family, we look at the owl out through the window. So you can see him by day, but he's not doing anything. He's catnapping. That owl wasn't interested in flying or foraging. He was just taking a little nap there. You might notice, unfortunately, that owls of various kind are very vulnerable to being road-killed. And let me explain what owls are doing. That people all often ask, why do I see so many barred owls dead on the road or great horned owl? Well, they have the forward vision. They have the binocular eyes. They're on one side of the road, and they look across the road, and they see something tasty, and they go after it. They're flying after it. Well, they don't see that Big Mac truck coming. And so they're very vulnerable to roadways because they're foraging along. They're sitting on one side of the road, and they see something tasty on the other. So anyway, that's our great horned owl pitch, and I hope people get to hear that one and understand it. And it's a good neighbor to have. They're eating rats and other mammals that we don't necessarily want in big numbers, so they're keeping those things in check.
And I happen to have stumbled upon one of those a couple of years ago during this show and caught that. A lot of background noise, but it was in my apartment complex right across the street from where we're at right now at Red River Radio.
Right.
And last month we had a call about the ivory-billed woodpecker, and you wanted to clear up something. So we're going to play a little clip from last week's show for everybody.
Let's listen.
And I have a curious question. Do we have any audio quality recordings of ivory bill?
Yes, and those were actually recorded in this state, in Louisiana, near not far from Monroe, Louisiana, is the Tensaw National Wildlife Refuge. Well, before it was the Tensaw, it was the Singer Tract, as in the Singer Sewing Machine Company. They owned a big chunk of land near Tallulah, Louisiana. And so some researchers from LSU... Okay, researchers from LSU. I got several emails from people correcting me on that, and it was researchers from Cornell Lab of Ornithology from Ithaca. So, sorry, LSU. I guess I was thinking about the campus I'm sitting on here, LSUS. but it was the correct group was in the 30s and 40s was the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And I did mention that later as they have on their website a lot of audio and some of the video that Arthur Allen and Peter Paul Kellogg took, and we have some of that because we promised to play the sound of the ivory build, so Bill's going to play that right here.
It sounds almost like a geese.
A little bit like geese. That was a couple birds at the end doing some contact calls, but at the beginning you heard just the tooting. And a lot of the description in the early literature talked about sounding like a little boy's trumpet was how it was described. Well, we mentioned we would play that because we talked about how a lot of people confuse the ivory billed, because it's a large woodpecker, with the pileated woodpecker. And I mentioned, I think I said something extreme like it's as different as Dolly Parton's voice from, maybe I said Willie Nelson, or did I say Johnny Cash?
I think it was Johnny Cash.
Yeah, I don't remember, but I had to pick some names that everybody knows.
I'm not sure who was Dolly and who's Johnny here.
Well, they're so different. So remember the tooting we heard, and now Bill's going to play the pileated.
Sounds almost like laughter.
Just completely different. So you shouldn't confuse the voice, especially of those two woodpeckers. So I do want to make a shout out to the people that did email me about that, and here we are correcting it. I don't think we've done any corrections like this before.
No, so far we've been lucky.
So we've been pretty good, but we did want to fix that and give the credit to Cornell, and thank goodness that they did those recordings in the 30s. And we could spend an hour talking about how they did it. I'm not the person to actually describe how they did it with the equipment back then, but it was remarkable to know how they recorded it. And thank goodness they did, because that's really our best recordings. And they have photos to go with it from northeastern Louisiana. So
yeah, that was very likely a parabolic microphone, which is like a satellite dish,
right?
Only instead of a receiver for your television signal pointing down into the dish, it's actually a microphone, and the dish gathers up all the sounds and focuses it just like a lens.
Right, right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and he can be reached right now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. We have three calls waiting. Den from Dry Prong and Mike from Hallsville, please hang on the line. We've got Donnie up first from El Dorado. Donnie, what's your question tonight?
Well, it's Tony, first of all, but that's okay. The question I had, growing up in the 60s and 70s, we had lots and lots of bobwhite quail in North Louisiana and South Arkansas. And as everybody knows, they have disappeared. I've heard many theories as to why. Habitat being probably the biggest one, but I know that when the clear cuts were first put in for timber, there were still lots of quail in the second and third year, and we still have clear cuts and no quail. Another theory I've heard is that the worse the fire ants got, the fewer the quail were because they nest on the ground. I was just wondering if you had any ideas on that, and also any knowledge of any attempts to restock quail. And I'll hang up, and I'll thank you for the call.
Great. Thanks for the call. And that's a great question, one that we've discussed before. I don't mind going over it again because it is heartbreaking to know that that was a common bird in the listing area, and it's almost extirpated from much, not all, of the listing area. But if you were going to do that with a quiz and you listed all those things, I would say the answer is D, all of the above. So you can put blame on a lot of those things you mentioned, but there's not one nail in the coffin for the bobwhite. It's several different nails, but I'm a habitat guy, and that, to me, always rises to the top. And so it's the assault that we've had against native grasses, and that has taken time. So when you think about change, you have to think about it with a dimmer switch. Talking about a light switch on the wall, it's not just up or down, on or off, quick like that. What we've done has taken decades to do, and we are now finishing up the dimmer switch. It's almost gone from slightly dim to black out with the bobwhite. And so it's an assault on conditions that bird needed, and namely native grasses. People drive around the area and they say, I see tons of grasslands. Well, it's not the right kind. For example, coastal Bermuda is a carpet grass with nowhere to hide. Bobwhite do not like sitting up on top of grass, running around, feeding. Also, the coastal Bermuda for much of the year is a biological desert. There's nothing to eat. So instead, they needed native grasses that are bunch grasses that are separated by some distance that allowed the bobwhite to be on the ground and walk and run around on the ground covered by these bunch grasses that gave it cover. So the clear cutting was good as long as we let native grasses come back up with it. But again, assault on native grasses, we've wanted to herbicide anything that competes with our target product, and that's going to be namely loblolly pine in this area. So anything that's going to take up space or shade out that target plant, we're going to assault. We're going to put out herbicide and get rid of it. So we've added herbicide to the equation. So it's again a dimmer switch. It's multiple nails in the coffin. We could go on and on about it. It's very depressing. It's not just bobwhite. There are a lot of other birds riding the coattail of the bobwhite's decline, namely continentally, eastern meadowlark and loggerhead shrike. Those are biggies. And there are a lot of people concerned about all those species, and they're trying to do things in some cases separately, which is ridiculous. They need to get all in the same room, work all together, because it's not that you're working just to bring back quail, nothing else, or you're just working to bring back shrikes and nothing else. They're trying to bring back the habitat. that all those species plus many more would benefit from. So it's grassland, native grassland restoration is the issue. That's what we're lacking, and that's what everybody should be working on together for planning and restoration to bring back habitat. And also in big blocks. That's a big thing about Bob White. They need big acreage. You can't start thinking about Bob White unless you've got 10,000 acres or more. So if you got 50 acres here and you want to bring back Bob White, that's like building a house, but all you can afford is the coat closet. Where else are you going to live? You got to build the kitchen, the bedrooms, the living room, mm-hmm. the porch. You have to think big acreage for Bob White. And so 10,000 acre blocks or bigger. And we just aren't having that anymore.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can call us right now at 800-552-8502. We have lines open. That's 800-552-8502. Any questions regarding birds and our avian world? And we have two callers online right now. Mike, please hang on for a few moments more. Den from Dry Prong, you're up next. What's your question tonight?
I noticed that blue jays act a lot like crows. Mm-hmm. But also in the fall and winter, they use a different vocabulary than they do in the spring and summer.
Yep.
I was wondering if the blue jays that are here now are mostly migratory, and they're just using a different dialect, or if they just swap it up in the
Hey, that's a great question. You're certainly paying attention to the vocalizations, and it's true the jays and the crows are related. They're in the family Corvidae. They're also with magpies and ravens, so they all are in the same family. And we do get an influx in the winter of blue jays. So they're what we call a short-range migrant. And we know that places that have reservoirs in the fall and the spring, especially in the fall, if you have a reservoir and you've got a woodlot on the edge and the birds are wanting to cross that water, they often stack up. And I've seen this at Sam Rayburn. I've got a buddy named Richard Kinney that's seen this at Lake Tewakene, and I could keep naming other lakes. But when those blue jays are flying south and they've got to cross that water, even though they can see the other side, they're stacking up. But that gives the bird watcher or the biologist a peek at what's going on. These are birds that are stacking up in numbers, and all of a sudden they'll just start crossing the water, and you'll see 30s and 40s flying over these bodies of water. And that doesn't stop just there. You can be in the river bottoms and see big flights of blue jays in October in the fall coming south. So, yes, the answer is you've got birds that probably bred to our north. I don't know, maybe Missouri, maybe farther, maybe Indiana. I don't really know. I don't know anybody that's tag those birds or put what we call geolocators on to see where they came from, but we do get an influx in the winter. So if you look year round, you're going to have your greatest numbers of blue jays in the colder months because we're on the receiving ground of those more northerly birds. So good perception there, good question. I love those. Keep them coming.
Thanks a lot, Den. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and the lines are open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Mike from Hallsville, you're on the line with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
All right. Well, I recently started to notice that there were certain birds. I couldn't tell the species, but it's a small bird, and it seems to be nesting inside of where you have your street lights, not street lights,
yeah.
The stop lights.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what other like instances have we noticed of different species of bird, you know, using, you know, like cities as their habitat.
Well, the two that come to mind that fit the description you're talking about is the European starling and the house sparrow. Those both will nest in close association with humans, and urbanization has really made them increase. And I have, like you, seen them go into pipes, open pipes, like the end of a stoplight where there's a beam where the light's hanging and there's a horizontal pipe. Well, it doesn't have an end cap. Well, starlings will go in there because they're cavity nesters. So to them, it's like a hollow in a tree, but even better because they can tolerate all the noise and the congestion of the traffic. But guess what? The predators don't like that. They're not going to be cats walking around that are going to come try climbing up that tree because, A, they can't climb up a slick metal pole, and, B, they're not going to be messing around with all the traffic. So starling is probably your number one bird, and house sparrow is number two for doing what you described. And the answer is yes, they are doing well because they're closely tied to humans. Yep.
All right.
All right. You cool. Good, Mike? All right. Thank you for calling, Mike.
Thanks.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now, so you can get right in. And we do have an online question that was sent to you, Cliff. And this was submitted by listener Greg Grant from Tyler, Texas. And he said, Cliff, I cleared a 20-acre mixed forest 4 years ago and planted longleaf pine. 2 years ago, I heard a bobwhite quail in there, but nothing last year. Is there anything I can do to improve my chances of having them back? I planted native grasses and wildflowers and burn annually for fear I don't own enough land. Thanks for the advice, and I love the program, he says.
Well, Greg's doing the right thing. What he described doing on his property is exactly what we need to do to bring back Bob White and others, but we're going back to two or three callers ago where we mentioned that Bob White needs big real estate. So Greg's asking for advice. The next thing he needs to do, and it's tough to say, we'll go buy 10,000 acres next door.
Yeah, that's kind of hard to come up
that's,
with.
Yeah, unless you've got a certain last name with a lot of money. You know, Rockefeller maybe, you can do that, but that's not an option. So another option is just start working with your neighboring landowners to see if they're interested in the same target you are, and then collectively you might have several hundred acres, and then you talk to more neighbors or have those neighbors talk to the other neighbors. And anyway, you just want that to spread like wildfire to get the word out, to work together with the same goal. We have, in Texas, we have what are called wildlife management associations, and those are landowner groups that have meetings on sometimes a regular basis, maybe monthly. And that's exactly what these groups are. They're neighbors that all get together to talk about how they can do things to promote wildlife. And so real estate is the answer to what Greg needs to do. He needs to work with bigger acreage to bring in Bob White. Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. I haven't gotten the name from this from our crew back there yet, but we're just going to go to our next caller. Hello, caller. Could you give us your name, tell us where you're from, and then ask your question? Hello? Ah, there
can
we
you
go.
Hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hello, this is Dustin from Kilgore. I had two questions, if you don't mind.
Okay.
My first question is, on our front awning, we have a bird that every year makes a nest in the corner of where the pillar meets the ceiling, and it's kind of like a mud compacted nest.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, what type of bird is that, and what is the likelihood that it's the same bird every year, or will they reuse, or other birds reuse the nest?
Okay, there are a couple choices. If it's strictly mud, then it's going to probably be a barn swallow. But if it's got a little bit of moss in it, eastern phoebes will do that as well. The adults look very different. So the barn swallow's got a deeply forked tail and just flies around like a fighter jet. So I don't know if that helps any to identify it, but I'm going to guess it's one of those two, barn swallow or eastern phoebe. They will come back and use that same spot. If it's the mud nest of a barn swallow, typically that mud goes dry and crumbles and falls off, but there might still be a little lip of that mud left, or whatever they use as a lip to anchor the nest, and they'll re-nest at that spot. A phoebe, you'll find that they'll come back and nest and add new material and makes it taller. And so an old phoebe nest can be 3 or 4 years worth of stuff that's kind of stacked up. They just, instead of tearing out the old, they just add new stuff and a little bling, and boom, they have babies. So I'm guessing, go ahead.
This one does have like some straw material mixed in.
Uh-huh.
And I have noticed it's grown in size, so that would kind of narrow it down.
Yeah, then that's probably the Eastern Phoebe. You can look that up to see a picture to see if that matches what you see whizzing in and out. That's a flycatcher. So either way, they're both insectivorous, the Phoebe and the swallow. So they are excellent neighbors to have. I wish I had them under my front porch because they're eating flies and other pesky insects. So I'd want those on my front porch.
Well, that's great. Yep. One follow-up question. Where do they get that material from? Is that something like regurgitated food, or what do they do
if,
with that?
So on the barn swallow, while we're talking about it, which we don't think your bird is, but I'll mention that that's mud that they fly over to a mud hole somewhere where there's a drying edge, but it's still muddy on the edge, and they grab a beakful. And they do that, I don't know, 700 times, and that builds a nest. I don't know the number. I made that up. It might be 7,000 trips to make that mud nest. But your Phoebe, that's fine plant material. It's gleaning that from the ground parts of it. It's gleaning that from the trees. Some of it's going to be lichen that it gleans off of the bark of trees. So they're just, it's like going to the grocery store and going up and down all the aisles, filling your grocery basket. Well, this bird is doing something similar, but instead of filling a basket, since it can't carry it all, it's doing it, you know, a little bit at a time. But it's fine plant material. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, my secondary question was, I go fishing on Lake of the Pines pretty often, and in the last couple of years, it seems like we've noticed an influx of bald eagles.
Okay.
And my question is, how pervasive are the bald eagles in East Texas? Is this a natural area for them to occur in? And is it really, are we actually seeing a greater influx of them, or is it just me?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, Dustin. We are seeing an influx, and that's the benefit of no more DDT, and it's just taken a while for them to recover. In Texas in the 70s, there were about 7 or 9 known nests, and now we have probably 300. That doesn't even include the wintering birds like what you're seeing on Lake of the Pines in the winter months if you're fishing. Some of those are going to be more northerly breeding birds that come down to overwinter with us because we don't have water that freezes over like they do in Alberta or North Dakota. So we are seeing an influx, and those of us that have been doing bald eagles on these lakes for 30, 40 years are the ones that notice it. So if you're a teenager and you go out, you that's where you start your barometer. You're like, wow, look at all these bald eagles. It's always been like this. Uh-uh. The 70-year-old guy that's on the boat, he's going to be the one to tell you, it wasn't like this, Sonny, in the 60s and 70s. He's got that perspective, that long-term perspective, to note that we are seeing an increase in bald eagles. And that's great. It's our national bird. It's also a success story of doing simple things like removing this harsh chemical that's killing a lot of our piscivorous birds. It was killing brown pelicans, osprey, peregrines. A lot of our top predators were dying because of DDT. So there's other factors as well, but that's the big nail in the coffin. And because that's no longer used, we are seeing lots more bald eagles. And I think that's great. So thanks, Dustin.
All right. Thank you, Dustin, for calling in with your question. And just a note, back home where I come from, Ohio, we had lost all the bald eagles, all the peregrine falcons. My alma mater was the Falcons, and there were no falcons around.
Yeah.
And they started coming back in the mid-80s.
So uh-huh.
They're back in full force now, along with Canada
well,
geese.
Well, maybe they'll let you go back to school, Bill, and you can be a falcon again if you want.
There you go.
Would you want to do that?
No, I don't want to go back to school. I'm too old to do that. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have 3 calls online right now. Bailey from Linden and Belinda from Leesville, please hang on. And Becky also, please hang on. We just got another one. John, you're next. Tell us where you're from, John, and you're on Bird Calls. What's your question?
This is John. I'm from Pollock, actually Fishville, Louisiana, which is about 20 miles east of Alexandria.
Okay.
My question, are you hearing me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, my question is about purple martins. I used to, 3 years ago, I had about eight nests, eight boxes, and they have, you know, 12 nests in each box, full of purple martins. Last year and this year, I don't have any.
Mm-hmm.
What went wrong? I hear that it's the migratory bird is getting confused by all these radio wave antennas. Is that what it is?
Well, I don't know. Is your radio on, John?
No, I turned it off, but there must be some kind of echo problem here.
There is an echo. What is that, Bill?
That's a good question. That's probably it's just coming back through his phone speaker.
Okay. How's that? Can you hear me, John?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, that sounds better. I don't hear the echo now. Yeah, and I think a long-time purple martin fanciers or landlords, they have good years and bad years. You got to think about that. Wildlife just is not, it's not the same thing every year. Bird abundance is kind of like the economy. It's up and down.
Yeah.
And so you just experienced a down year. If you had all your money in a 401k and it went down, you know what to do. Just leave it in there. Wait for the long term. It'll come back up. So that's what I'd encourage you to do with your purple martins is just wait. You're going to have a good year.
Now, I did make a mistake by putting I had six boxes, big things with all those holes. And I mounted it up on an old flagpole, but it had about 8 foot of pole above those boxes. And then I learned that they don't like to have anything above their nesting. And I thought maybe that was one of the mistakes.
Well, I don't know that, but if you've heard that, is it much trouble for you to deal with that?
Yeah, I've already rearranged
that. Okay, well, then you can try to see if maybe that corrected it. But
it makes sense because they don't like to have a nest near an overhanging tree where predators can sit.
That's right. They like it open and clear. So, and that's important to know because I know a lot of people that go through the effort of buying a purple martin box. They visited their family or friend that had one. They said, oh, we can do that. And they come back to their forested backyard and they put up a purple martin house. Well, it doesn't work in the woods. So you have to have an opening.
Yeah.
You got to have a field. And then again, you just aren't going to have a great year every year with breeding birds.
I'm glad to hear that then because that was sort of my pet.
I've
been here for 40 years and this is the first time I've not had all of them here picking on me.
Well,
here in the garden.
you've had a good run then with your 401k then, haven't you?
Yes,
stick with it, John. You're doing good stuff, sir.
I'm just a new listener. Only the second time I've heard you.
Good.
You guys are doing great.
Hey, all right, John. Thank you.
All right,
thank you so much.
Everybody.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Belinda and Becky, please stay on the line with us. We've got one caller ahead of you right now, Bailey from Linden, Texas. Please, what's your question tonight?
Yeah, my question is about hummingbirds. I live in Memphis, and I put out my hummingbird feeder.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there's one bird coming dominant. I have two feeders out.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's one bird fights all the rest of them trying to come up there.
Yeah.
And what is the proper time of year to put those up? I forgot to take them down in Memphis and they froze, so I don't know whether to take them down or when the hummingbirds come back again.
Right. Well, Bailey, what we recommend in the South is to leave your hummingbird feeder up year-round, and that doesn't jive with how Grandpa told you or Grandma said, oh, you better take it down or they're not going to migrate. Well, guess what? You don't have that kind of power or control over migration. Those birds are hardwired to go south. When it's time to go, they will go. There's always food available wherever they are. So leave your feeder up. You might get lucky and have an overwintering hummingbird. So we did that. We got lucky this year in my backyard. My wife and I have, and we're very happy to have a female Rufus hummingbird overwintering with us. She showed up on, of all days, Halloween Day in October and was hard to find for the first 4 to 6 weeks and lately has been very easy to see coming into our feeder. So that the fun part with that was in this cold spell that we had for the last 10 days, the really cold stuff where our feeder would freeze in the middle of the night. So one of us had to get up before dawn and put a new feeder out that had stayed in overnight, that stayed thawed. That way, when the hummingbird got up to feed at first light, there was actually nectar that they could get to. It wasn't frozen solid. So keep your feeders up year-round. You're not going to keep them anchored by having those feeders up. Instead, if you do get lucky like we are with a rufous hummingbird, it will save those birds that are overwintering, because with that super cold snap, it killed everything. All the flowers that we had left over, like Turk's cap, they're gone. So guess what? They really are reliant, or dependent rather, on the feeder. So keep your feeder up. And you mentioned that you had two feeders, and one, it sounded like one might be a bully. So what you want to do is use the house as a barrier and put one feeder on one side of the house and the other feeder on the other. That way the bully can't monitor both hummingbird feeders, okay? So
okay, one other thing on that. I put one of them over my garage.
Uh-huh.
It got full of ants. And man, I tell you, they seem to thrive on ants. I never knew a hummingbird like ants.
You mean that the ants like the hummingbird nectar? Is that what you said?
Yeah, the nectar got full of ants.
Yeah.
It seems like the hummingbird just flocked to that thing. They were crazy about that one.
Yeah, and you know, that's sugar water is loved by a lot of critters, and fire ants and various other kinds of ants will definitely tap into that. So you need to get you can buy a contraption that's like a moat. It's called a predator guard or an insect guard, and you can get that. It's a little adapter that goes between your chain and the feeder, and ants can't penetrate that. So look into that product. That will help with the ant problem. Okay.
I have one other quick question.
Okay.
I have a problem with squirrels, and I've seen owls up. Do those fake owls help any?
You have a problem with squirrels, and what was the rest?
And I've seen people put fake owls in trees.
Oh, yeah.
Those little things work.
Well, if you're trying to sell owl decoys, it sure is nice. But no, all of a sudden that squirrel says that thing hadn't moved in 14 days. He's figured it out. So snake decoys, owl decoys, those don't work, no.
All right. Thank you very much, Bailey, for your call, and we hope you keep listening. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've got Becky on hold for a few more minutes. Becky, please stay with us. Belinda from Leesville, you're up next. What's your question? Hello, Belinda.
Or maybe it's Becky. Which one is it?
This is Becky.
Well, this is Becky.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we got the wrong one there, and I'm sorry, Belinda. No. I went to Becky first.
Becky's the right one.
There
right?
you go. Take it away,
That's
Becky.
It. Okay. My question is about pine siskins, and actually, Cliff may have answered it when he talked to the guy about the purple martins, how the damage may increase and decrease like a 401k.
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of pine siskins this year, and the last couple of years, none.
Yeah.
Is that an indicator of anything at all, or is that random?
It's an indicator that you're witnessing what we call an eruptive, starts with the letter I, eruptive species. And an eruptive species is one that fluctuates greatly winter to winter. Pine siskin is one of those. We still usually get pine siskins every year, little numbers, but some peak into big blowout years. That's an eruptive year, and then next, maybe for a couple years, it'll be high, and then it'll go back down. Purple finch, evening grosbeak, there's a whole bunch of red-breasted nuthatch, there's a whole bunch of those here in the south that we call eruptive species, and that's what you're witnessing. It's part of the bird. So I wouldn't get worried about those years you don't have a lot of pine siskins. You might say, hey, I'm saving a little money on that very expensive thistle seed, right?
Right.
Yeah. So maybe spend that money on something else, but just know that if you keep with it, stick with it, there'll be another year or two where you're going to have the big numbers, and you're going to be calling me saying, I need help. I can't afford to feed all these pine siskins. So,
Let me ask you real quickly then, what is a good feed to put out to attract a grosbeak?
Well, if I mentioned evening grosbeak, but in this listening area, that is a super rare bird. If you've got an evening grosbeak, he's yellow, white, and black. Take a picture. That is a bird that's really hard to find. A black oil sunflower will attract a lot of these things. But for the pine siskin and the goldfinch, the thistle is the best. And with a goldfinch or siskin feeder, that will exclude the bigger birds, the blackbirds and the grackles and the things you don't want eating that expensive caviar that you're putting out. Because that black thistle is expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, but
is there anything in particular to attract any kind of grosbeak around here in East
Texas? Again, in the winter, if we're going to have an evening grosbeak, it's going to come to the feeder that's got black oil sunflower, and that's what you're going to be putting out for the cardinals and the titmice and the chickadees and the house finches anyway. So no, there's nothing extra to put out for an evening grosbeak.
Okay, great. Thank
yeah.
you so much.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Becky, for your call. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have one caller online. The rest of the lines are open right now. So go ahead and call us at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Okay, Belinda, we're finally getting to you. Belinda, what's your question tonight from Leesville?
Yes, I've got an unusual problem. I haven't heard of this before, but probably somebody else has had it happen.
Okay, go ahead.
I have an old farm truck with a camper shell on it, and it closes, and I usually keep it locked, but somehow birds got up through the holes because, mm-hmm. again, old farm truck, it's got some rusted out holes in the bed.
Yep.
And they got in through those, and I had to keep going and letting them out every morning because they'd be pecking on the camper shell whenever I woke up. So I finally left the thing open, and they've just set up shop there. What do I do? How do I relocate them properly?
Well, have you figured out what they are? Are they Carolina wrens?
I don't know how to identify them.
Okay.
I can't see them well enough.
Right. I'm guessing that they're Carolina wrens. I don't have nothing in front of me to tell me what they are. I'm just going based on what you described. And Carolina wrens are very curious, and especially in the breeding season, they're looking to get into your tool shed, your barn, and your camper top is no different. So there's safety and security and dryness from the rain and safety from cats by doing this. And so if you want to exclude them, find the holes that they're crawling in and plug them up if it's driving you crazy. It can't be a whole lot. If this is a camper that is still being used, unless you know it's just rotten, then get rid of it. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just saying if we're talking about a camper that you're still using, certainly there's not 67 holes that you got to plug up. There's probably one or two. So it shouldn't be that difficult to find those holes and fill them up with something to keep out the wrens and other birds. Okay. Does that sound good, Belinda?
Oh, I got one other question.
Oh, okay.
My dad had given my sister and me a jar-type squirrel feeder.
Uh-huh.
And the feeder fell apart, so I put the jar on a shelf in the greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
It has some gaps in it. It was a freebie. You know what they say about beggars and choosers.
Yep.
And I have found a nest in it, a bird's nest made of the pine straw we have all over
mm-hmm.
here.
Yep, there are a lot of birds that would use that, like a cavity or a nest box. It could be, again, Carolina wren would do that. Tufted titmouse might do that. Carolina chickadee might do that. I've seen eastern bluebirds nest in weird places. And speaking of all this, I wish Cornell still had their program called Funky Nest Photo Contest or something like that. Funky Nest program. Anyway, this is where you would get on there and look through hours and hours it would take you to go through all these pictures people have sent in of weird nest placement, and you'd see several other people with camper tops because you're not alone with that one, and you'd see several with these glass jar feeders you described with nests in it. And I don't even know, I haven't looked in a while if they've kept those websites up, but I don't think they accept photos anymore, but I used to love looking through those. So maybe look to see if Cornell still has their Funky Nest program, or if they've They still have the website up. You can look through those, Belinda, and you'll see exactly what you described, plus a whole lot more. It's pretty interesting.
Cliff, how do I persuade them to leave, the ones that are moved in, since I've left the camper top open?
Well, okay, you open the camper top, they've flown out, that's when you got to plug it right away. While you're there, they're not going to get back in.
I just let go and left the camper top open for quite a while because I got tired of playing doorman.
Right, and so what you're doing with that is encouraging regular use by the Carolina Wren.
Now what do I do?
Well, then you need to
beyond the plug.
You need to close it, and then at the same time look for these holes that we've talked about, and then if you're sure nobody's in there, plug up the holes and be done with it, and then don't open the door again.
But what I'm saying is, what if I find nests and things in there?
This time of the year, there's nobody nesting. If you're a Carolina Wren, you're doomed if you're nesting now, and their hormones aren't even working that way. So this is the time to do it. Do it this week. That's your homework assignment for now. Don't wait till April, because they will be nesting in April, but right now, uh-uh. So guess what you're going to be doing this weekend?
Thank you, Cliff.
All right, Belinda. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Belinda. And we're going to go next to Doyle from Homer. Doyle, what's your question tonight?
I have a pond on my property that is about 2 acres.
Okay.
And I seldom see wild ducks.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to attract wild ducks and geese to my pond.
Okay.
Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, you need to drain that pond and start over. Because 9.9 times out of 10, that pond is designed to feed cattle and horses, water the livestock. It is not designed to attract ducks. Now, I know people have stock ponds that will attract ducks, but tell me that you have a duck every day or more than several times a year seen a duck on a stock pond. It happens. I'm not saying that, but if you really want to do it right, you want to have your pond made for ducks, not for livestock. And that means completely starting over. So that's going to be my answer, is you want it to be more shallow, especially the edges. What happens with a typical stock tank, it's like a bathtub. It's got no edge. It's got no shallow end. It just goes straight down. And so
my pond does have a shallow end.
It needs to have
very natural.
It needs to have a lot of mud. It needs to have a lot of vegetation. If it's just open water and you can see the open water, most ducks aren't going to like that. They need to have some smartweed and some other vegetation, native aquatic vegetation, that will attract them. So if I can see open water over most of it, it's just not going to be very duck friendly. Okay.
Well, it does have that. It does have natural vegetation around all the sides except in one small area.
Well,
that's cleared off.
Okay. The last thing I'd recommend is to put up a wood duck box. Have you done that yet?
No, I haven't.
Okay, that's easy then, because what I was saying about revamping your pond, there's about $20,000 right there, right, to get all the tractors and all that. So an easy, cheap fix is put up a wood duck box, and you can get the blueprints online. It'll tell you how tall to put it, what direction to face it. You can find all that out online, and that's what I'd recommend doing, and you're talking about a half-day project and under $100. So that might help you, Doyle, and hopefully that'll work.
I'll give it a try.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Doyle, for your call tonight. And we have one last, this was an online question from Sarah Kupka. And she took a photo near Alice in Texas. And it was a bird that we have covered before, but she wanted you to identify that on air. Could you tell us about
this
bird?
Those were not too distant photos of a red-tailed hawk. Are you going to put those online?
They are online.
Oh, they're already there. And this one is interesting because it's got a lot of chestnut on the chest. And so a quick glance, you might think red-shouldered hawk, but if you look carefully, it's got the belly band. It's a little chunkier, more robust, just stronger looking than a red-shouldered. This is a red-tailed hawk. and it's a nice one. So I encourage people to go online and look at those pictures on our website.
Yes, indeed. And we have some sound effects from that that we had already had, so you can kind of hear that screech.
Yep. And that's the red-tailed hawk. Yep. Cool. Very, very hoarse squeal. So.
Indeed. And finally, we're going to move on to our conservation tip for this week. What do you have for us, Cliff?
Well, we're going to talk about feathers and other bird parts, and they're fully protected. So it's tempting to pick up that roadkill owl or that windowkill hawk and keep it. Some might even think about calling their local taxidermist, asking for a price estimate to mount that owl or that hawk for their living room. But species that are not hunted, which are known as non-game, and include owls, hawks, woodpeckers, and songbirds of various kind, these are protected by state and federal laws. Those laws protect birds even when they're dead, even when their death was accidental, along the roadside or flying into your window. Without a permit, one cannot possess these birds or any parts of these birds, including feathers. While this may seem extreme, if you were found with the bird or even with feathers, a game warden wouldn't know if you killed it or it was really found as a roadkill. So the best thing to do is to leave it alone or give it give the deceased bird a swift and proper burial. Birds like waterfowl, quail, and turkey, species collectively known as game birds, they of course can be kept and mounted on the wall as long as they were legally taken. There are a couple of exceptions to the non-game birds. Universities or natural history museums, they may have a biologist on staff with a salvage permit to collect birds that are already dead. A nearby nature center, wildlife management area, or national wildlife refuge may have an educational display permit to have mounted birds for display. However tempting it might be to pick up that fresh dead bird, don't do it unless you're permitted. Know the game laws to help protect yourself and the birds around you. Do it for the birds.
And you have been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And this is Red River Radio. He is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help on this program. And Cliff, again, I want to personally thank you for joining us
again this week. Thanks to you, Bill. You do a great job over there with the switchboard and working
it
all.
Sometimes. All right. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. The producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford. We had help tonight from Wally Derleth, Tim Schnell, and Sheila Lawrence. And the program audio for this show will be posted on our website in a short while. You can visit us at redriverradio.org and just go to Bird Calls. And remember, if you have a photo or sound clip of a bird you'd like Cliff to identify, you can send that to my email address. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. This is Red River Radio, and stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next here on Red River Radio with a very interesting program for our insect lovers out there, a program about fireflies, ants, and the things that we can learn from their community and how they survive. This is Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Stay tuned. Radio Lab coming up next here on Red River Radio.